For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Into the ongoing conversation that we've been having in this Sangha about the times that we're living in, about things like power and privilege and leadership and crisis of leadership and conflict, as well as wisdom and compassion. Homer is really good medicine. A thing that happened last week was that people were wondering what, you know, where would be the Bodhisattva? Somebody said, well, is it going to be Achilles as Bodhisattva? Is it going to be Hector as Bodhisattva? I'm most interested in Homer as a manifestation in the world of Bodhisattva energy. And I want to start by talking about the kind of influence in the world that Homer and the Homeric poems has been. So here are a couple of examples. There's a therapist in New England named Jonathan Shea, who for many years did therapy groups with Vietnam veterans suffering from PTSD. And he used the Iliad with them. Later he used the Odyssey. But they found reading the Iliad terrifically therapeutic and healing. For whatever reason, part of it was that they saw their experience represented with so much truthfulness and so much authenticity, so many aspects of all the things that were packed into the trauma that they were carrying, that they found it healing. I remember earlier in my life when there was talk about, the dumbing down of America and worries about humanity's education dwindling. And I remember hearing people say, you know, everybody in the world, like if they become a doctor or a lawyer, they ought to have the experience of weeping with Achilles and Priam. I think that's remarkable. And I have to say, you know, as a faculty member at an elite institution, I have to say, I don't think we do a very good job these days of transmitting, you know, to the students that we have, who are by and large people who are going to go on to be leaders or at the very least, you know, people of elite standing and privilege in the world. I think that there's medicine and there's power in this text that that for various reasons doesn't get accessed in the way that it could. Some of those reasons are very valid. They have to do with things like identity politics and becoming more aware and conscious of privilege. I think those things are important. And at the same time, I think the Iliad is a delivery system of a particular experience that I'm summing up as wisdom and compassion. And as somebody who's a brand new Buddhist looking at the Iliad and thinking about it with newly naive, wide-eyed Buddhist eyes, I'm feeling amazed at how much healing power and bodhisattva power I see right now in the Iliad. So I should also say I do a fair amount of teaching in the genre called continuing education. I teach in programs where students are people my age or people who have professional careers and are not in any way academic specialists. And I love that kind of teaching. So in what I'm saying tonight, even though I am, of course, at moments going to geek out, my aim is to, there's nothing that I'm going to say that depends on a prior knowledge or familiarity with the Iliad. So let me start with the question, what is the Iliad? So here's the Greek Iliad that I've had ever since forever. you know, in two volumes, this product of modern, you know, Enlightenment scholarship. This thing came into being maybe 700, maybe 800 years BCE, somewhere around there. It's in 24 books. It's got 15,000 verses, so it's kind of like a sutra, interestingly. And it sort of tells the story of the Trojan War. It's set in the Trojan War. The name Iliad means the Song of Troy. It's thought of as the wellspring, the origin of all cultural knowledge in the ancient Greek world. People said that Homer knew everything, that you could learn everything about how to live from reading Homer. You could learn how to be a great speaker, you could learn how to make things, and you could learn how to live. When I suggest that to people, sometimes they're really indignant. They say to me, "What you mean that we should all learn how to bash each other's brains out?" You know, and I was like, "No, it's the end of the Iliad. It's the end. It's what happens at the end of the Iliad, with a suggestion that this is a paradigm for how to live together in the world." So I want to start entering into the Iliad by sharing with you a text that comes from Roman times. It comes from 146 BCE, and that's the year that the Romans defeated and destroyed Carthage. Carthage was this imperial city in North Africa. Rome and Carthage were the great rivals in the ancient Mediterranean world, and they fought for over a century before the Romans accomplished more or less a genocide of Carthage. We live in a world where things like demonizing the other and rage is something that we see in the news every day. And I grew up in a world where being American meant hating, you know, certain groups, hating communism, hating a number of other groups. So the Romans and the Carthaginians were like that. The Romans, for example, had a saying, Punica Fides, which meant Carthaginian trustworthiness, and that means being a lying sack of poop, right? They had nannies would say to children, Hannibal at the gates. Hannibal was the great general who brought elephants into Italy and almost defeated the Romans. So Hannibal became a monster, a kind of boogeyman. We're told that Hannibal himself, when he was a boy, was taken to an altar by his father, and his father made him swear eternal hatred against the Romans. So the story I'm about to read to you, and I'm going to screen share it, is the story of the Roman general Scipio Aemilianus, who was the general at the moment when Carthage was being destroyed by the Romans. And so we might wonder, how does he respond? How does he respond in this moment? You know, does he encourage his men to pillage, to loot, to rape and kill? Or does he take the moral high ground and say, you know, they were bad people, you know, sort of, you know, World War II allies, kind of, you know, we fought and justice won out, something like that? Or does he, you know, does he thank the gods? Does he thank the divine sky father? His reaction is so remarkably different, so stunning. And so I want to share it with you now. This is from a later historian called Appian. So Scipio looked upon the city of Carthage, a city which had reached its peak of power 700 years after its foundation. So this is what Scipio is thinking. A city that had ruled over so many lands and islands and seas, a city rich with arms and fleets, elephants and money, a city equal to the mightiest kingdoms, but far surpassing them in bravery and endurance. Since without ships or arms, and in the face of famine, it had sustained continuous war for 3 years, a city that now was coming to its end in total annihilation. And as Scipio looked on, he is said to have shed tears, openly weeping for his enemies. meditating deeply for a long time. And the Greek here has this really interesting word, en-nous, which means en-minded, being en-minded for a long time. That's about as close as Greek can say going into a deep state of samadhi, right? Meditating deeply for a long time, he reflected upon the rise and fall of cities, nations, empires, and individuals as well, right? So he is meditating on universal impermanence. He thought of what happened to Troy, that once fortunate city, to the Assyrians, to the Medes, to the Persians who surpassed them all in power, and later to the splendid Macedonian Empire. And as he considered all these things, he said out loud, either deliberately or because the words of the poet, and when you say the poet in this world, you mean Homer, the words of the poet escaped his lips. A day will come when sacred Troy shall perish, and Priam and his people shall be slain. And when Polybius spoke to Scipio freely, for Polybius had been Scipio's teacher, and asked him the meanings of his words, they say that without any attempt at concealment, he named his own country. He said that when he reflected on the condition of all human things, he felt fear for what must eventually happen to Rome. Polybius heard him speak these words and recorded them in his history. So I want to make the claim that this meditation that Scipio went into and quoted Homer at the end, I want to suggest that this is the influence of Homer in the world, that this general who is watching the destruction, you know, of his country's centuries-long enemy, has this remarkable moment of wisdom and compassion, right? I mean, he's looking at Carthage and thinking about Carthage as a being that has a life, right? He thinks to himself, 700 years ago, this city came into being, like every society of human beings coming together for happiness and flourishing. And then he thinks about other great empires that have also perished and that everything comes to, you know, comes to the end of death. And his mind is roaming over time, right? He's sort of thinking of the past of the past and the future of the past. And when he quotes Hector at the end, Hector is the prince of Troy. And this is a beautiful moment where he's bidding farewell to his wife Andromache before he goes into battle. He'll never see her again. And he utters this prophecy. He says, the day will come when sacred Troy will perish. And it's only then that Scipio names his own city. So my suggestion here is that this is the influence of Homer's, I still want to say it, bodhisattva energy in the world. I think it's really interesting to think of that passage almost as if it were a koan, a case, and to read it with the eye of practice. And interesting is too weak a word. I think it's powerful, and I think it's really timely. So I'm going to go through the Iliad at a certain point, but first I want to say some things about, alas for you, about my understanding of Mahayana Buddhism that I've, you know, come to in the last few months, and I'm going to say a few things about Homer on somewhat less shaky ground. But the things about Mahayana Buddhism. So I had heard this term, bodhisattva, and I had gathered that it refers to, you know, great exceptional beings who do this thing of putting their own personal enlightenment on hold for the salvation or liberation of others. But I didn't at all get, I had never heard really the Mahayana teaching that is encoded in the Buddhist liturgy, right? If when you come to a Buddhist service, very often you chant the bodhisattva vows, and when I chant the bodhisattva vows, I am making the promise to live up to being, to live up to bodhisattva nature. So if you ask a Mahayana Buddhist, you know, like, what are you like, you know, on a mission to save the world? The answer is no. We're on a mission to save all beings. We're all together on this Mahayana, which means big vehicle, big bus. You know, we're all on this big go-kart together, all living out whatever this thing is. That's a very new thought to me, and it's one that is still it's still sinking in for me. And so there are three aspects of the bodhisattva nature that have struck me over the last few months. And the first one is this thing, wisdom and compassion. I asked Wade specifically to chant the Heart Sutra. It's the first of these texts that I came across when I started coming here. And again, it's a text that I feel like I had studiously avoided. But by your leave, I want to go back to this PowerPoint slide and show you the next slide. So I'm going to geek out on Sanskrit, which is a language that I studied a little bit in graduate school. And it's interesting, as I learned from an article that Taigen invited me to look at, it might be that the Chinese is actually the earlier version of this sutra. But here's the thing that I'm interested in that strikes me. And I can get the little spotlight thingy. Here's the name Avalokiteshvara, and it means downward Lord, the Lord, the Ishvara, with the downward look. And that's often, right, that's often explained as referring to the downward look of compassion, looking down with kindness upon us. But in the Sanskrit text of the sutra, this just really blew my mind. When it says, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, while deeply practicing wisdom perfection, while doing the deep doing that is Prajnaparamita, looks down upon the five skandhas. So in other words, the verb that describes this action of looking down upon whatever these five skandhas are, these five levels of reality experience, and sees them as empty of specificity, empty of self-being. That look that is the look of compassion, I think this tradition tells me, is also the look of wisdom that looks into what exists and sees beyond differences. So I think you get where I'm going. I'm thinking about Scipio looking at Carthage and seeing a sense in which, even though he had been taught all his life to hate Carthaginians, there's a sense in which there's no Roman and no Carthaginian. There's a sense in which that's a truth that his heart, that his mind saw as his heart opened up. And these are the Chinese characters that are this is how the name Avalokiteshvara Guanzu Zai is rendered in the Heart Sutra, and it seems to mean something like observing self-being or contemplating at ease, which seems to refer to the look of wisdom. But we know the more familiar name of this bodhisattva, Guan Shi Yin or Guan Yin, meaning something like hearing the sounds of the world. So I'll stop the screen share again. And I want to show you two images that I own. So I've had this Avalokiteshvara for many, many years, not really knowing or understanding a thing about Avalokiteshvara, but just loving this image so much. And this looks to me like the look of wisdom. Avalokiteshvara here is holding a lotus. And it actually has the Heart Sutra in Chinese. And then this is a very very ordinary, sort of like an ordinary Blessed Virgin image of Guanyin with the medicine vase, and this to me looks like the downward look of compassion. It's from Shohaku it's from Okumura's commentary on the Heart Sutra that I read this thing, that this idea that one of the things that the Heart Sutra is about is that wisdom and compassion go hand in hand. When I first looked at this sutra about emptiness, that seemed very conceptual. And the suggestion that I get from that commentary is that this thing of saying it, no sight, no sound, somehow there's a heart's ease, there's a softening of the mind, a softening of the heart that accompanies that increasing experience of wisdom. I also read in that commentary that the setting of the Heart Sutra is Buddha's zazen, right? Which means I think that the setting of it is your zazen and my zazen, and that the downward look that we do when we face the wall is that downward look of wisdom and the downward look of compassion and the downward look of Scipio looking at the destruction of the enemy that he had been taught to hate. And later, at the end of the Iliad, the downward look of Achilles looking at an old man who is the king of Troy, who is begging for the body of his son so that he can bury that son. And I'm going to get to that. So wisdom and compassion. I'll go quickly through things number two and three that have really struck me about this bodhisattva ideal. And they are, being upright. I'm quoting the title of Reb Anderson's book, the connection between sitting zazen and ethics, the precepts and the paramitas. That continues to amaze and astound me about this tradition. As somebody who did the sort of therapeutic style of mindfulness meditation for 11 years, and I'm super grateful to it. But it turns out, right, that there's this other dimension of sitting that it isn't just connected to my life, that it is the practice. It's the practice of living my life. And somehow or other, the ethical culture, the ethical framework that is alive in me with the education that I received, you know, starting with parents and elementary school teachers, somehow that's present with me always on the cushion. And I'm going to leave it at that for now. But being upright is the second thing that has struck and amazed me about the bodhisattva ideal. And the third one is, and here I'll quote the title of a book of Taigen, Awakening Space and Time. And this thought of bodhisattva energy as this archetypal energy that pervades everywhere. And so I'm so grateful that in this tradition, as I enter into this tradition, it feels to me like energies like the energy of Homer or the energy of Bach, you can see some Bach music at the piano behind me, are not on the other side of some cultural fence for me anymore. I'm not sort of, you know, stepping outside the Buddhist fence, you know, that energy, that powerful, ennobling energy that I experience in things like the poetry of Homer and the music of Bach is bodhisattva energy, is Buddha nature alive and stirring me and calling me to a particular way of living. So that's bodhisattva. Let me say the wonders of Homer, according to me, they are three in number, and I'll go through them faster. Homer, first of all, is the name of a transcendental bundle of energy. There's no evidence of a human being named Homer. We don't know how these poems came into being. There was a centuries-long oral tradition of transmission. Obviously, at some point, this thing got written down. Homer might mean the compiler, but there's a suggestion in ancient Greek culture that Homer is present any time that the Homeric poems are sung. All the poets call themselves Homeridae, children of Homer. And so there's a suggestion that Homer is going to be here tonight. Homer is going to join us and be here with us tonight. And what is here anyway, right? I'm so happy that Tigan is bringing forms and ceremonies into this online Zendo that makes there be more here-ness. And yet, here we are, and where is here, right? And I feel like the only way that I can experience the togetherness and here-ness of whatever this thing is by, you know, by swallowing some measure of the nostalgia and pain and hunger, right? Of being together and breathing the same air and, you know, experiencing all the things that are experienced by being in a room with somebody and somehow owning that makes that phenomenology of presence happen. But that's a thing that happens in poetry. That's a thing that happens through Homer. The second wonder of Homer for me is that it's a national epic, but it is the least nationalist of any poem that I can think of, right? The enemy, the Trojans, are portrayed as heroes. They are ennobled. They're grieved for. They're praised. We see their inner lives. We see their virtues and their imperfections. There's no demonizing or dehumanizing of the other. It's really an astonishing thing, really astonishing. That respect for the enemy that Scipio expressed, I mean, it seems to me that is particularly a Homeric virtue, and it's astonishing that it comes out in that moment. And then the third wonder is the end of the poem that is the thing that I'm going to work up to, the way that the poem ends. So now I'm going to run a little bit through the plot of the Iliad. As Aristotle says, the Iliad is such that we would only get one tragedy out of it. And what does he mean? I mean, there's this big cast of characters in the Iliad, but he means that the main action itself, which, by the way, spans less than 2 months. It's less than 60 days. It's not a story of the 10 years of the Greeks fighting the Trojans. And apparently some version of that happened in history. And it was the first thing that the Greek speakers did. Instead of, you know, little communities fighting each other every season, for a change, they banded together and, you know, went and destroyed somebody else. And the Homeric poem is Panhellenic, amazingly. I mean, it has forms from different moments in the history of the language. It has forms from different dialects. It's a unique sort of record of an entire people. I think I put the cast of characters, or a little cast of a few characters, on my next slide, which might be useful to look at. Yeah. So just to let you see these names, so some of the characters. So on the Greek side is King Agamemnon, who is a walking leadership crisis. Achilles, who is the best warrior of the Greeks. Patroclus, Achilles' beloved squire, attendant, and companion from childhood, who gets killed by Hector in the poem. And then on the Trojan side, King Priam, paragon of happiness, with his 50 sons and 50 daughters living together with him in the palace. Maybe some people wouldn't think of that as a paragon of happiness, but anyway, it's a symbol and sign of his, you know, overweening prosperity. And then Hector, Priam's son, the great defender of Troy, who in some ways becomes, if not the hero, at least the co-star of the poem. alongside Achilles. So the poem starts with a quarrel. It starts at this moment where the Greeks, in the 10th year of trying to take Troy down, and it's looking like it's never going to work, things become even worse. And Agamemnon, the leader, becomes even more unhinged than before. Presumably he had these great leadership skills when he brought the Greek army together, but he is losing it now, and he's losing it in ways that that really look strangely familiar. I've spent years teaching this poem and saying, well, this is hard for us to understand because as Americans we have all of these you know, cautions and systems and understandings in place. Our leaders don't sink to this level and wrangle like competitors in the contest for honor, and that's no longer the case. So here's what happens. This is a world where if somebody comes to you with a supplication, begging for something, you take it seriously. So a priest of Apollo named Chryses comes to Agamemnon with a wheelbarrow of treasure and says, please give me back my daughter. You own my daughter as a slave because you guys conquered my city, and now you have my daughter as a prize. That's what they did. You know, they would conquer a city and then line up all the possessions, including the beautiful elite women, and they would be assigned as prizes to the warriors. And he says to Agamemnon, the priest says, please take this ransom. That's how this is supposed to work, and give me back my daughter. And Agamemnon says, no way, get out of here if you want to escape with your life. I like your daughter, and I'm going to keep her. I like her better than my wife. So he adds that just to be crass and brutal and to humiliate. And the old man goes away, and he's afraid. And the old man prays to Apollo and says, you know, punish the Greeks for my tears, make them pay. And Apollo does. Apollo begins shooting his arrows at the Greeks. And the arrows of Apollo are plague, right? And so people start dying. And they start dying, and there are piles of corpses and more corpses than they can burn. And so now there's a leadership crisis and there's a plague crisis happening. And Agamemnon doesn't do anything about the plague. And days pass, and Achilles calls an assembly. He's been inspired to do it by Hera because she cares for the Greeks who are dying. He calls the assembly and he says, we've got to do something. We've got to do something. Let's ask the prophet. Let's ask the prophet Calchas what's up. And Calchas stands up and says, Achilles, I'll tell you what's up, but you're going to have to promise to protect me because King Agamemnon is not going to like hearing this. And then Calchas speaks after Achilles says, I will protect you. And Calchas says, here's the deal. Agamemnon has dishonored the priest of Apollo, and now we are being punished by plague. And so Agamemnon must give up this prize. And Agamemnon says again, no way. No way that I'm going to be the only one of you guys who doesn't have my prize. So I'll give this girl away. I have to. Okay, I have to. But you got to make it good. You've got to give me an equal one in return. And it's Achilles who stands up and says, we don't do that. What are you talking about? It's as if he says to him, you know, your majesty, we may be archaic warriors, but we have the concept of private property. You can't take a warrior's prize back after the community has awarded it. To which Agamemnon says, fine, I'll take your prize, Achilles. I will take your woman. I will take Briseis. And try to stop me. So that's what happens. And Achilles says, well, then I'm not going to fight for you. This is not my war. The Trojans didn't do anything to me. And Agamemnon says, good riddance, go to your tent. And that's what happens for most of the poem. Achilles sits in his tent, plays his lyre, studies the lore of antiquity, sings about the heroes of old. While the Greeks, his people, are dying because the tide of war turns. In the ninth book, so it's a 24-book poem, and the main actions are book 1, book 9, book 16, and 24. It's very geometric. At book 9, Agamemnon sees that, okay, this is going to result in our utter destruction. So he sends an embassy. He sends a a set of announcers to Achilles. That's not the way that you do a supplication. You do it yourself. Agamemnon doesn't show up, but he throws all these goods at Achilles, you know, offering him slave women, offering him one of his daughters, offering him lands. And Achilles sees through it, that it's a bid really saying, you know, submit to me. And he refuses it. And he says an amazing thing. He says, it has come to my knowledge, it has come to my notice that whether a man is courageous and fights in battle as I've done in my life, or whether a man is a coward and does nothing, he's going to die. So Achilles has come to realize, he's come to acknowledge the inevitability and the universality of death in a new way. There's a thing that I want to show very quickly that Achilles says here. He says, it turns out that my mother, the goddess Thetis, who is the god of the sea, has told me that my life is going to go one of two ways. If I stay here and fight beside the city of the Trojans, my return home is gone, but my glory will be unwithering. But if I return home to the beloved land of my fathers, the excellence of my glory is gone, but there will be a long life left for me, and my end in death will not come quickly. So I'm interested in this phrase, my glory will be unwithering. It's in Greek, I'm going to geek out again. In Greek, it's kleos aphthiton. And as one of my professors discovered, in the Rig Veda, there's a hymn to Indra that has this same phrase, shravas akshitam. The Sanskrit language and the Greek language are cognate with each other. They come from the same root. And I love that. I love that on so many levels. It's a thing that I think matters for me as someone who is en route to becoming an American Zen Buddhist. You know, Wade chanted that ancestor lineage that starts in India and then goes to China and then Japan and then comes to America. It moves me to think about the fact that Homer and you and I and Shakyamuni Buddha speak languages that have a common ancestor. And that phrase that I just said, shravas akshitam, I'm like, wow, that's a phrase that Shakyamuni Buddha knew, right? And the language that I'm speaking, these ancient artifacts, you know, which are, after all, a way that Dharma gets transmitted, have come to us, right? They have wrapped the globe, right? The English language has come to us in one direction, right? Westward. And I got the directions wrong. Anyway, you know, from India has come to us this the language that we speak from that part of the world. And in the other direction, right, Dharma transmission has taken place, has come here. I find that very moving and very beautiful. There's a passage from the Flower Ornament Sutra that we read recently in a reading group that seems to me to offer some reflection about the status of things like Homer in the world and what it might to think about Homer as manifesting bodhisattva energy. So I'll read. It says, the Buddha body is inconceivable. All lands exist therein. In all places there, he guides the world, teaching truth. In the subtle teaching he expounds, the essence of things is undifferentiated. Based on the one real truth, he expounds various characteristics of things. Buddha, with a round, complete sound, exposes the genuine truth according to differences in understandings. He manifests infinite teachings. In all lands we see Buddha sitting on the enlightenment site. Buddha's body appears like reflections. Its birth or death cannot be found. There are other poems in this same section that go on to say the same thing about the inconceivable Buddha body being expressed in different languages, in different places, to people with different kinds of understanding. I really love the idea of thinking about Homer and the Iliad fitting into that system. So moving forward in the poem, so the failed embassy that was not a proper supplication from Agamemnon didn't produce any change, and the Trojans continue to pummel the Greeks. The old man Nestor has this idea, which he suggests to Patroclus, who is Achilles' beloved friend. And Patroclus takes him up on the suggestion. So at the beginning of book 16, Patroclus goes to Achilles and says, "Man, what are you? What are you? Are you like descended from a tree or a rock? I don't know you. Your people are dying and you're just sitting in your tent and you're the most powerful warrior. Do something, man." And then he says, "At least let me wear your armor and let me go into battle and terrify the Trojans, and they'll run." And Achilles says, okay, you win. You can't take my spear because you can't carry it, and don't go too far and don't get killed." And he goes out and he gets killed, right? He gets killed by Hector, of course. Apollo helps. Apollo hits him very hard in the back, and then Hector finishes him off. And then an amazing thing happens to Achilles. Achilles, of course, discovers that, oh, he does have a reason to go into battle. And he's already making this strange discovery that, oh, there's something that he loves more than honor. There's something that he cares about more than this thing that his culture and his world has told him is the thing that makes human life worth living. But I think this is one of the places where the poem is very therapeutic for those who suffer from PTSD, because Achilles berserks. He rushes into battle like a demon. He captures 12 young men and leads them off for human sacrifice. There's a man named Lycaon who kneels down and begs for his life and says, "Achilles, you know me. You took ransom from me before, and now I'm back, and here I am facing you. Isn't it funny?" And Achilles says, "Sorry, that was last season. You know, now that Patroclus is dead, I don't take any prisoners and I don't take any ransom." And he slaughters Patroclus, right, as Patroclus is on his knees begging for his life. And he continues until he gets to the city of Troy, and all the other Trojans have run inside, and Hector is standing outside. And Hector says to himself, "There's no way I can go inside, because my bad leadership decisions have led to this rout that has killed so many of my men today. I can't walk in that town and face my people. I have to stand my ground and face Achilles," which he does until Achilles gets so close that he's terrified and runs. Eventually he stops. Achilles kills Hector. And Achilles, the interesting thing, killing Hector doesn't make Achilles stop being angry. The next thing that Achilles does is he drives leather thongs through the ankles of Hector and attaches Hector to his chariot and drags the body away. Achilles then leads funeral games for Patroclus, and he does it in a brilliant way with brilliant, wonderful leadership. That's the 23rd book of the poem. And then at the beginning of the final book of the poem, the funeral games are over, and the funeral games were beautiful. The funeral games are the origin of things like the Olympic Games, right? That's a sacred reenactment of war. To honor the heroic dead. That's what it comes from in Greek culture, and that's why it has that sacred element. And Achilles did it brilliantly. And now that it's over, he collapses again. Funeral didn't do for him what funeral is supposed to do, right? The other Greeks, you know, walked home having processed and metabolized the death of Patroclus, but not Achilles. For 12 days, Achilles toggles between two different things: lying on the shore and grieving for Patroclus and crying his eyes out, so giving way to sorrow. And the other thing he does is goes back to his chariot and drive the body of Hector, drag it around, right? Trying somehow to continue to vent his anger, vent his rage at Hector, who's dead. The gods protect the body from rot all this time. So now, here we are at the end of the poem, the end of this weird 51 or whatever it is, 55 days in the Trojan War, that time that the Greeks almost got pummeled in the 10th year. And Achilles is writhing on the seashore when he's not dragging the body of Hector around. Meantime, Priam, the king of Troy, is grieving his son Hector in a heap of dung, right, and kneading it with his fingers and covering himself in it, and as it were trying to turn himself into a corpse. So the gods send messengers to both of these parties, and Iris, the goddess of the rainbow sent by Zeus, inspires Priam with an amazing idea. Priam decides, you know, there is one thing left that I can do in my life, and that is I can get together a wheelbarrow full of treasure, walk to Achilles, make a supplication, and get back the body of my son, and give my son his burial. And Achilles' mother Thetis comes to Achilles and says, you know, stop doing this. Eat a proper meal. Have some sex. Don't do this. Go back into your tent. And at that, so that's what happens. Priam goes with just one man accompanying him, an elder. And then he's met by Hermes. He's met by Hermes, who is remarkably like the Bodhisattva Manjushri, this amazing trickster of wisdom. And the first thing that Hermes does is help Priam get in touch with his mortal terror. Because when he sees Hermes, Priam suddenly realizes that he is an old man accompanied by another old man carrying a wheelbarrow full of treasure in no man's land, right, between the Greeks and the Trojans, so that anyone could pick him off. Once Hermes has, you know, helped Priam to see that one of the things that he has to reconnect with is his mortal fear, Hermes then becomes his protector and guide. So Priam is making his way to Achilles, and what he's doing, right, is meditating on the skillful means that will allow this supplication to happen, right, that will make it work. So Hermes gets into the tent, and he appears, as it were, miraculously, wondrously. I want to read to you the supplication that Achilles makes to Priam, and then Priam's response, and then I'm pretty much done. So here we go. So Priam appears before Achilles in Achilles' tent. Priam, the great king of Troy, passed by the others, knelt down, took in his arms Achilles' knees, and kissed the hands of wrath that killed his son. Now a simile, a comparison. When taken with mad folly in his own land, a man does murder and in exile finds refuge in some rich house, then all who see him stand in wondrous awe. That's how these men stood. Achilles gazed in wonder at the splendid king, and his companions marveled too, all silent, with glances to and fro. So that's the first thing that happens. Priam is kneeling there, kissing Achilles' hands, and Achilles is looking down in wonder and awe. And so Priam speaks, and he says, "Remember your own father, Achilles, in your godlike youth. His years, like mine, are many, and he stands upon the fearful doorstep of old age. He, too, is hard-pressed, it may be, by those around him, there being no one able to defend him from bane of war and ruin. Ah, but he may nonetheless hear news of you alive, and so with glad heart hope through all his days for sight of his dear son come back from Troy, while I have deathly fortune. Noble sons I fathered here, but scarce one man has left me. 50 I had when the Achaeans came, 19 out of a single belly, others born of attendant women. Most are gone. Raging war cut their knees from under them. And he who stood alone among them all, their champion and Troy's 10 days ago, you killed him, fighting for his land, my prince, Hector. It is for him that I have come among these ships, to beg him back from you, and I bring ransom without stint. Achilles, be reverent toward the great gods and take pity on me. Remember your own father. Think me more pitiful by far, since I have brought myself to do what no man else has done before, to lift to my lips the hand of one who killed my son. So Priam is inviting Achilles to look deep into things, to look, to say, look at this old man. Look at me, Priam, the king of Troy, miserable old man coming to beg for my son, who is the one that you hate more than anybody else because he killed your Patroclus. But you have a father too, and you love your father, and you know that you'll never see your father again. And there's this thing that you can do. There's this thing that you can do, right? That is the noblest thing that you could do in this moment. And that is to give me back my son for burial, right? Simply that. Simply that. I want to read it in one more version. This is Alexander Pope from 1721, who wrote this while Bach was writing the Well-Tempered Clavier. It's so gorgeous. It's got these and thous, but it really gets so much more of this link between wisdom and compassion. Priam is really inviting Achilles to soften his heart by looking deep into reality. So here's Priam again. Unseen by these, the king his entry made, and prostrate now before Achilles laid, sudden, a venerable sight appears, embraced his knees and bathed his hands in tears. Those direful hands his kisses pressed, and brewed even with the best, the dearest of his blood. As when a wretch who, conscious of his crime, pursued for murder, flies his native clime, just gains some frontier, breathless, pale, amazed, all gaze, all wonder, thus Achilles gazed. Thus stood the attendants, stupid with surprise, all mute, yet seemed to question with their eyes. Each looked on the other, none the silence broke, till thus at last the kingly suppliant spoke. Ah, think, thou favored of the powers divine, think of thy father's age and pity mine. In me that father's reverend image trace, those silver hairs, that venerable face, his trembling limbs, his helpless person see, in all my equal but in misery. Yet now perhaps some turn of human fate expels him helpless from his peaceful state. Think, from some powerful foe thou seest him fly and beg protection with a feeble cry. Yet still one comfort in his soul may rise. He hears his son still lives to glad his eyes. And hearing still may hope, a better day may send him thee to chase that foe away. No comfort to my griefs, no hopes remain. The best, the bravest of my sons are slain. Yet what a race! Before Greece to Ilion came, the pledge of many a loved and loving dame. 19 one mother bore, dead, all are dead. How oft, alas, has wretched Priam bled? Still one was left, there lost a recompense, his father's hope, his country's last defense. Him too thy rage has slain. Beneath thy steel, unhappy in his country's cause, he fell. For him, through hostile camps, I bent my way. For him, thus prostrate at thy feet, I lay. Large gifts proportioned to thy wrath I bear. Oh, hear the wretched and the gods revere. Think of thy father and this face. Behold, see him in me as helpless and as old, though not as wretched. There he yields to me, the first of men in sovereign misery. Thus forced to kneel, thus groveling to embrace the scourge and ruin of my realm and race, suppliant my children's murderer to implore and kiss those hands, yet reeking with their gore. I used to call that melodramatic. What I see about it now is that it's so skillful, right? It is so skillful. Priam is teaching. He is teaching the younger man Achilles how to see, how to look with a soft mind. And it works. It works. Achilles doesn't suddenly become a bodhisattva saint, because in his answer, he doesn't say whether he'll do it. And Hector says, Priam says, well, you are going to give me the body. And Achilles says, don't tempt my anger. And Achilles, I've decided to give you the body. And he storms away. He also keeps the body. Achilles keeps the body from Priam's sight before it's time for Priam to leave, because he knows that if Priam sees the body, Priam will say angry things to Achilles, and Achilles will get angry and will kill Hector with one blow. And my favorite moment of skillfulness, skillful generosity on Achilles' part, is where Achilles says to Priam, so how long will it take to do the funeral? And Priam says, we can do it all in 11 days. And Achilles says, I will make an 11-day truce happen, and on the 12th day, we'll resume the war. And so Priam goes back with the body of Achilles. Three women sing funeral dirges, his wife Andromache, his mother Hecuba, and then Helen of Troy. And the poem ends with a description of going into the woods, cutting down the pyre, doing all the feasting, all the solemnities. And the last line of the Iliad, the last line of the poem about the Trojan War, says, and that's how they buried Hector, tamer of horses. This is the tomb of Hector. This is the eternal glory of Achilles, and this is the tomb of Hector. It's as if this poem is giving us the message that the most significant thing and the most glorious thing that happened in the Trojan War was that moment of Achilles's heart opening out in wisdom and compassion, and allowing that thing to happen that was the burial, the heroic burial of Hector. May our practice open our eyes of wisdom and our hearts of compassion to help us find appropriate response in this difficult and painful time. Thank you, Bodhisattvas.
Thank you very much, David. We've gone a little bit late, but so if people have to go, please feel free to do that. But if anyone would like to give some question or comment or response to David, please feel free. I'll just say that I asked David to give his talk because I love Homer and remember reading Homer as a teenager, reading the Iliad as a teenager, and just feeling heartbroken that these two wonderful heroes, Achilles and Hector, had to fight each other and one of them had to die. And it was just like this great koan for me. Anybody, any comments or responses? Yes, Paul, please.
Thank you very much, David. That was wonderful. And I'm not a classicist. I haven't read it since I was a teenager, like Ty again. But what I got out of it was the great warmth and feeling and compassion that you have for these characters in this situation. And it was just wonderful to see your love and attention and dedication to this body of knowledge. And I think it's a wonderful international, timeless understanding of humanity, and your passion and compassion for it is quite wonderful to see. Thank you very much.
Alex. You're muted.
I just wanted to say that I really enjoyed the talk a lot. I think the way that these old stories can affect us is just so powerful. And I think I feel, you know, like what Paul said, I felt the passion and the compassion for the characters in the text. And I think I feel similarly about the Mahabharata. So, you know, the way that these texts come to us and they're just laden with so much meaning, and it just gathers layers and layers throughout time and space, you know, in such a ways that, you know, someone like Homer can be a bodhisattva, and it lives through time like that. So I really love the talk, and I'm really just emotional at the end of it, the fact that they end this whole thing with, and that's how they buried Hector. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Once a student asked me, how come Tamer of Horses? And the short, you know, a classicist might say, well, that's the epic formula. When Hector's name appears in that position in the line, he's supposed to be Hector, Tamer of Horses. But why is he Tamer of Horses? It's because the part of him that's being mourned in that moment is the sexy, beautiful cowboy that he was in his youth. And that is the manner of his princely leadership, right? That is being mourned in that moment by his mother and his wife and Helen of Troy and the whole city. And to be sure, cowboy leadership is a problem. Okay. We see the way that it's a problem in the Iliad too. Hector says to one of his counselors, if you cross me again, I will kill you. So he's got, you know, Hector's not perfect either. He's got cowboy leadership for good and bad. But yes, thank you.
I thought you were going to say that Agamemnon became a stable genius.
Became what?
An unstable stable.
You know, it's interesting. I find myself often saying to students, get interested in Agamemnon. Have some compassion for Agamemnon. Get interested in his story. What's going on with him? I find it harder to do that with the person that I'm tempted to compare Agamemnon to, and that says something about me.
I really love Homer and really the characters in this epic and the Odyssey teach something about the quality, as you say, of leadership, but just of humanity. But I did not know what you said about the roots of Greek and of Sanskrit being the same, and that's powerful, that these ancient epics, whether it's Buddhist sutras or Homer, have so much rich story to tell us. So we have many kinds of ancestors. Yes, Niozan, please. Niozan.
Am I there?
Yes. Oh, it remuted you. That's weird, Niozan. I can't hear you now.
Now?
Yes.
Good. Yes, thank you. That was a really very moving talk that makes me, you know, another person who's not read Homer since my teenage years. Now I'm going to go, like, find the right box and dig it out. It was beautiful, really moving. But I have a very specific thing that I wanted to ask you. When you were sort of parsing the language of the Prajnaparamita and the line when comes in, deeply practicing Prajnaparamita, and you sort of took apart that line a little bit, could you repeat that? That was really interesting. Do you remember?
Sure. So in the Sanskrit, it's, let me do my little thingy again. Spotlight. Okay. So it's, charamano is a participle. So it's doing the deep Prajnaparamita doing is what it literally says. I don't know what the Chinese says, but that's what the Sanskrit says. So it says doing the deep Prajnaparamita doing.
Thank you.
It's cool, right?
Yeah, very cool.
I wanted to say a thing about the roots, the Greek and Sanskrit roots, because it's an interesting story about sort of talking back to British imperialism. the man who discovered that English and Greek and Sanskrit and Latin all have the same root was this guy, Sir William Jones, who went to India. They sent him away to be a high court judge there because he was sort of a peacenik telling King George to leave the American colonists alone. And so he went and he studied even more Sanskrit than he had known. And he came back and in 1799, he gave a talk to the Royal Academy where he said, I've been studying Sanskrit and I've discovered that this language has got to come from a common ancestor with Latin and Greek. And furthermore, the language and culture is so much more elaborate and powerful than Latin and Greek. So, you know, he was letting them know so much for your civilizing mission, you know, bringing civilization to India. It turns out Indian civilization is far richer and the language shares a common ancestor. You know, so that was sort of in the face of British imperialism.
We have so much to learn from ancient cultures.
David, thank you so much. What an excellent, excellent presentation. I just been all over the map with emotions and education and wow. I've just been wow. The enthusiasm that you bring to it and the passion is really, really an experience. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Doug. That means a lot to me. I really appreciate it. I'm glad you're here.
Me too.
I believe Ed has a question.
Ed?
Thank you, David. David, thank you for such a wonderful gift this evening. I'm so grateful for your reading. And I just want to crystallize something, and that your suggestion that one of the greatest manifestations of Greek glory in this instance was Achilles' wisdom and compassion of Priam. You seem to be suggesting that it was the glory resided in compassion, not in battle or exercise of athleticism in the exercise of death.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's new to me as well in the poem. So,
well, the argument sort of goes like this, and it's part of it is from my professor Gregory Nagy. It's like, what is this poem commemorating anyway? If it is Kleos Aphiton, if it is undying glory, like it's certainly not the story of how the Greeks fought at Troy for 10 years. This is a thing that happened in 51 or is it 54 days, It culminates in this moment where Achilles makes this gift of the body of Hector. You know,
And can I quote just this tiny bit of James Redfield in his book Nature and Culture in the Iliad? Mm. At the last sentence that he writes, the last two sentences, he says that what is necessary and yet unjustifiable in fact justifies itself in the end as an object of poetic knowledge. What is incomprehensible in experience becomes patterned and even beautiful in the imitation of experience. And since poetic imitation, which claims to stand outside experience, is itself a human achievement, poetry claims for itself a place both outside and within the human world as it recovers for man a tragic meaning in the experience of meaninglessness. That's a slightly different take on the poem in terms of the experience of human loss as a primary driver of compassion and empathy, right?
Yeah. Right.
It's present to me.
Right.
And Zeus sent this evil portion so that later, for men to come, we should be themes for song.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah, right, right.
So thank you. Thank you again for your reading. Deeply, deeply indebted to you for that. Your reading tonight. Thank you.
Ed, thank you so much for that. Thank you for sharing that quotation from my wonderful colleague, Jamie. And once again, that weird thing that happened, it's like, wait, I didn't realize before that Jamie Redfield's book is such a delivery system of Buddhist wisdom. I'm like, wow. It's like this stuff is everywhere. That's amazing.
It is.
Thank you. But it's important to acknowledge that a thing that is happening with Achilles is that he is learning that our shared mortality gives us a reason to care about each other.
Yes.
No? That's something to learn.
That's what binds us, ultimately.
That's something good to learn. Yeah.
That the gods don't have.
Yeah. I feel like, really, that thing that Scipio experiences at Carthage, that thing that Achilles experiences when he grants Priam's wish, they're passing moments, but it seems that that's what Zazen stands to cultivate for us. And if everybody experienced that experience, we would live in peace. We would be helping each other. It looks like Mike's hand is up.
Sorry, I'm a little dark, maybe hard to see. First off, thank you for your talk. Definitely, I think, as everyone has also said, your enthusiasm, not only for the topic, but in tying it to Buddhist practice is incredibly evident. And I think the way that you effortlessly, it seemed, talk about it, and not only in terms of how you presented the material, but in terms of your passion, is so enriching. And I feel very grateful that you are here to share that with us. Something that struck me, I think early on in your talk, you had mentioned Homer as a so ubiquitous in Greek culture. And I think you mentioned it was like, you know, when Greeks talk about the poet, it was, you know, no doubt of who you were referring to. Correct me if I'm wrong, Homer was blind, correct? Or as far as we know.
There's a Homeric hymn where Homer speaks and says that he's a blind poet. Yes, and so there's a long tradition that he's a blind seer. Yes.
Okay. That stuck with me the entire time in thinking about not only how someone who can't see could construct something and then write something so rich and so emotional, but especially in how you've elaborated on it. And a lot of what you were saying about Scipio and Avalokiteshvara, you know, looking down and that whole idea of looking down on wisdom, which is something that Homer couldn't do, or, you know, did in a completely different way than we all do. It's something that it was an image that really struck with me, and I thought was very beautiful, is how someone maybe can't see in the same way that we all do could understand, you know, and how they understand compassion. So that was something that I just thought of, so that I wanted to share. But thank you again for the talk.
That's beautiful. Thank you. Thank you. The thinking about the eye within, something like that. Yeah.
And when Mike mentioned that, somehow I was brought to mind Beethoven being deaf. Okay, sir.
Well, David, thank you so much for a masterful story and a beautiful story in some ways. I couldn't help but think about how these old stories talk about the consequences of action. Mm-hmm. And while it's really wonderful that there's sort of a moment of epiphany or revelation in, well, many moments actually in Homeric writings, there's also the consequences of very small slips lead to devastation. And I think about Zen practice, one of the maybe most poignant and powerful aspects is how much care, you know, that the precepts and the paramitas, that it's a refinement of responsibility and acknowledgement and awareness brought to every action. So I just, you know, I feel like there's a piece of this in there that these are very beautiful kind of openings, but also there's tremendous devastation and more to come, you know, in the sequel. And that there's a sense too that in reading this, that small little slip-ups or emotional outbursts have tremendous consequences of suffering. So.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Yeah, definitely. I had that thought as I was preparing the talk and thinking about these beautiful moments, Scipio at Carthage and Achilles. Scipio has this beautiful moment at Carthage, but that doesn't make him say, oh, stop the genocide of Carthage. He just has that beautiful moment and then goes on. And the same with Achilles and Priam. It doesn't suddenly make them live in peace. And the thing you say about cause and effect is really borne out relentlessly in the ancient poems, in the tragedies as well as the as well as the epic. Mm-hmm. I think of Oedipus too, which is another Greek work that is set in time of plague. Right, the city is dying of plague, and that's why they come to Oedipus. And of course, Athens was indeed suffering from a plague when Sophocles produced Oedipus, and Pericles of Athens died of that plague. Not so unprecedented times, after all. I see Xingyu's hand.
Thank you so much for the talk. I'm making this comment because it seems like people already don't care about how late it is. And I just feel like time passed so fast when you were giving the talk. Like it was just so intriguing, and I also can't imagine. I mean, as a Ishikawa student, we took classes in classics and things, but I never imagined a Buddhist practitioner talking about it. And I think your talk made me think about how these classics are not just tests of my reading skills, my English skills anyways, but there are ways to, there are books to live in some ways. I just find it very touching. And in some ways, like these, I just have the sense that these like stories or books, they depict like people or characters that are much simpler than real persons in some ways. Like in the sense that some of their qualities gets really refined. I don't know how to say it. Like I don't know. Like. The concept of courage and things like that. And I just find it to be very inspiring to hear something so pure in some ways. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for that. Thank you so much. I'm from giving this talk, I'm really keenly aware that when I teach the Iliad in a first year Hume core, I have not done the work of making sure that I deliver this thing about what happens at the end of the Iliad. I tend to do it much more Socratically, and it doesn't work that way. It's like it's my job. I realize this now, to bring that emotional understanding of the Iliad, because it doesn't come on a first reading. The Iliad is boring as hell the first time you read it. It's so complicated. It's just so hard to slog through. It's quite boring. And it can be taught in a very boring way. So there's that problem. Yeah. But it has a lot of psychological complexity, as well as that amazing, brutal, heroic purity that you're talking about. That's really true. Thank you.
I just have to say, I reread it a few years ago and found it fascinating.
One year there was somebody who was running for, I think, like student government president. And I remember the poster. This is on campus. It had her name and then it said, like reading the Iliad, only fun. Because as a first year core assignment, the Iliad doesn't usually feel like fun. Welcome to Chicago. Here, read the Iliad.
I, I'm pretty sure most of my friends told me the experience was going through it overnight before the class started, and it was just not fun.
Oh, I'm so shocked at the thought that students would read the whole thing the night before. What a horrible thought.
Yeah, that's not good.
David, you had mentioned that project the New York Times had assembled, and I think it was after the Afghan War, where the readings were made by the victims of PTSD. It's extremely powerful, the kind of recovery that you can witness visually in these warriors reading directly from the Iliad. And I recommend anyone to take an opportunity to view those tapes. There's nothing I've ever experienced like those. And it's something. You want to talk about the emotional content of that poem. There it is.
You know, one of the things that I've heard this said, that one of the things that's sometimes in PTSD is that it's very hard to metabolize how erotically exciting the experience of battle can be, and that's mm-hmm. part of what produces the trauma. Mm-hmm. And the Iliad really delivers that experience, but it delivers it with aesthetic distance, and that seems to be very therapeutic. The Iliad portrays the beauty of war as well as the hideousness of war. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. Could you just point us in the direction of the tapes that you're referring to, the project that you're referring to?
Ed, the thing I'm thinking of is Jonathan Shea's book, but you're thinking of a series of tapes. Is it from Jonathan Shea's therapy groups?
They're videotapes of these soldiers reading directly from the Iliad. Mm. And it's a series of, it's a montage or a collage of tapes of these soldiers reading from the Iliad. It's so powerful. And they,
Ed, do
they
you have links?
I want to say it was the New York Times. I'm sure that if it's Google, I thought, David, that's what you were referring to. But they read battle scenes, and they completely, what happens is these warriors suddenly acknowledge that their experience was real. They thought it was something they were imagining. And when they read the text, they recognize a shared experience by this poet. Mm-hmm. And it floors these men. And I'm sorry, I don't have the link, but I think if we Google, I'm not capable here to pull up another screen, but David, please see those. I think you would enjoy them. And anyone else, I'm going to find them. That's what I'll do. But
And how about the name of John? Is it Jonathan Shea? S-H-A-Y?
It might have been his project.
I'll put that in
the title of the book.
It's called Achilles in Vietnam.
Achilles in Vietnam. Okay.
I'm putting that in chat now. There you go.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, maybe after a wonderful presentation, it's time to bring this to a close. And Wade, maybe you could just lead us in the Four Bodhisattva vows.